Hi, my name is Dave Moore, and you are listening to the To The Point podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Summa Sportswear, where you can now use code KEAN10 to get 10% off all your Summa Sportswear products. Check them out on social media and on their website. Now, on to the episode. Brilliant, Dave. So I guess my first question I kind of ask to everyone is, it's a tough one, but how would you describe what it is you do?
Wow, that is a great question. I think what I do, because I do it with Derma, so I think what we do is we have the crack and everyone listens in, if that makes sense. It's like it's like the two of us are having a conversation in a pub and everyone can just kind of listen in and hear what we're doing. And I think that kind of informs everything we do. Like, what we try and do is have fun. We don't try necessarily be funny. I mean, he is obviously a comedian. He's a naturally funny guy. But our aim, I suppose, with the show, because we do so much stuff, so much different stuff on the show, is to have fun and to have that come across. And therefore, if that's kind of, that's your cornerstone of what you're building everything off is fun, you know?
That's really interesting. And can you give us like an idea into what's the day in the life of Dave Moore? What's the day in the life of Dermot and Dave? How does it all go?
Well, I am a creature of absolute habit, Keane. I love getting up at exactly the same time, doing exactly the same things. And if I get slightly out of my routine, my day is off. Gone. And I'm like, oh, I can't do this. So my alarm goes off at 5:41 a.m. every morning. And to be honest with you, I'm usually sitting there with my finger over it and I go, it goes beep, and I stop it. Already, my body clock is stuck on that. And what I do is I get up, shower, get into the car and drive to work. Then I park up and I meditate for however long I've got, maybe 15 minutes, half an hour, depending on how long I've got, in the car park in work. It's just a nice quiet place. Tilt the seat back a little bit and just have a quick meditation. Then once that's done, into work, a cup of tea and get stuck in to what needs to be done before the show. Then we have a meeting around 8 o'clock with the team and with Dermot, and we go through what we've got on the show, what holes we have to fill on the show in terms of content. And then obviously it's an open forum to suggest things that we can do for everybody. Some of them could be stories of the day. Some of them could be stuff from our lives. And no one, you know, it's not like a piece of content doesn't have to be a Dermot or Dave piece of content. Like, it could be, you know, Sean, who's in now for Maria, who's producing, he could have something, or Emer could have something, and we could easily do that piece of content as much as we could do whatever the big story of the day is, you know. So we just kind of pick all those little bits and we fill in the holes in the show, and then we just go and do it. And then there's a quick 5 minutes to go to the toilet, grab a bowl of porridge before the show itself starts at 9:00. And then we work through on air till 12:00. Then between 12 and 1, we have the studio, the one we're in, to do any kind of recording, so promos, any pre-recorded bits that we might do if we do an interview with somebody, or if we do, you know, if Noni needs to build some elaborate audio scape where she's, you know, stuck in Barack Obama Plaza with the Limerick curling game or whatever it is, then I would build that in that time that we have there. And then between kind of 1 and 2, you might have a meeting, a post-show meeting with your boss or with the team, or you might have to meet, you know, your show sponsor, or you might have to do something or whatever it is. But then usually you're kind of done at that stage. So, you know, in at 7, gone at 1:30, 2 o'clock kind of time. So it's a long enough day, but it's not prohibitively long. You know, it's not 10 or 11 hour day. And then you're free for the afternoon then to kind of do whatever needs to be done in your life, with your family. And, you know, everything can be content, you know. So whatever you're doing, you're always thinking, you know, is there something in this? Is there something that we can talk about on the show in whatever I'm doing? And 9 times out of 10, there isn't. But the odd time there is, you kind of grab it and go for it, you know.
So there's a lot more than just having the crack on radio. There's a lot of planning. There's a lot of kind of filling holes, as you mentioned there. How would you describe the last couple of years on Dermot and Dave? Have you almost kind of Where is the show going? Just from where you started, I see you now. You're interviewing lots of A-list celebrities. Then you're going on to an Oni segment. How do you feel the show? How do you feel the progress of the show has gone?
Well, we're bigger now than we've ever been, which is amazing. And I think we made a decision very early on during the COVID scenario, that we would be the respite, we would be the distraction, we would be the well of fun and positivity and crack for people, because we knew that every other rival was going to go the opposite way. And we're going to go, look, we need to tell people the number of people in hospital beds, number of people in ICU, the number of deaths. And it's not that we were burying our heads in the sand and didn't understand that that was reality. But we also knew that there were lots of places you could go to get that information. And you don't go to Dermot and Dave for that information. You'll get it on the news. And we knew that we would stay informed if there was a big, important piece, we would cover it. But ultimately, we still needed to interview celebrities and have the crack and tell bad jokes and do all those things that we do, and we do really well. So as a result of doing that, our numbers, our listener numbers, which are measured every 3 months, although a little bit less so during the kind of lockdown scenarios, but when they were measured, we just rocketed and rocketed and grew and grew. We now have higher numbers than they've had in the station for, I don't know, over 10 or 15 years. It's some crazy number like that, but it's as big as it has been, certainly since we've been there. And I suppose what it proves is that you can still be informed, but not be dragged down by all the information. You know what I mean? As a listener, as well as a show and as a presenter, like, you don't need to just go from one bad story to the next bad story. You can kind of mix it up and you can cover the serious stuff in a way and still maintain the show, be fun, and have that personality of the show remain true, as opposed to kind of diluting it or trying to do something that you're just not suited to doing. Like, that's never going to be a real positive thing. In terms of the A-list celebrities, that is really hard work by the team. So behind us, there are three people. There's the two presenters, and then there's a team of three. And it's only three, which I know to some people might sound like a lot, but if you look around the rest of the radio shows around the world, and even in Ireland, and even in our own radio station.
Team.
Yeah, I mean, three isn't a lot of people to do. We do 3 hours of heavy content. I mean, heavy as in a heavy amount of it. Every single day. We do 15 hours of that a week. And there's a lot in it. So we have a producer who's Maria Devereaux, who is currently on maternity leave, and Sean Reedy, who used to work with us, is now in producing us. We have Emer Shannon, and we have Cathal Minogue. And so Maria worked really hard to build relationships with the movie companies. And particularly over lockdown, what she did was she, because the movie interviews are, they usually happen in one way, which is the movie star goes to a hotel, and 15 media outlets go to the hotel, and one after the other go in and get 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, whatever it is, with the movie star, talk about the movie, and then you move on. And junkets have always been that way. But then when lockdown happened, we kind of went, oh, well, there'll be no more junkets. And there weren't any junkets in person, but they did the junkets over Zoom. And what it meant was then, because the celebrities didn't have to travel to Dublin or London or Paris or, you know, wherever, they could sit at home and they could do the interview that way. So our access all of a sudden ballooned, which landed exactly at the same time that all of Maria's hard work to generate this relationship with the movie companies kind of came together. So what it meant was that we ended up in a situation where we had all of this access to movie stars, but then the relationships with the movie companies to make sure that we got the access. And then what we do when we interview celebrities is we tend not to ask the same 15 questions that have been asked by everybody else that day. We do things that are slightly different, slightly more interesting, approach it in a certain way. And so then the movie companies are really happy to give us back more interviews and more interviews and more interviews. So it just kind of ends up being a situation where, like, we deliver good content. We've good relationships with the companies who decide who gets the chance to deliver the good content. And as a result, we've just kind of rocked it that way. So it wasn't a really conscious decision to say that we were missing A-list celebrity interviews on our show. I mean, everybody wants them.
Yeah.
But it was like, can this be a good piece of Dermot and Dave content? And we kind of felt like it could. So then we said, well, if it can be a good piece of Dermot and Dave content, like, let's do it to the best of our ability. And that meant, you know, working really hard, getting those things. And a lot of them were, you know, if the movie junket's in LA, your chances are you're going to be dialing in at 8:30 at night at home and you're not going to get off until 10:30. And a lot of the times, this is what we were doing. At one point, we had two junkets on the same night, one for The Matrix and one for Sing, the movie, Sing 2. And at one point, I got called into two interviews at the same time. And it was like, who do I talk to? The director of Sing 2 or Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss? And I'm sorry to the director of Sing 2, but I closed that laptop and talked to Keanu Reeves. But yeah, but it was, you know, it was a lot of work, but it really paid off. And now, certainly now, the movie companies are very aware that if they want their stars to get the best interview, the most fun interview, the most interesting interview they can do, they're going to come to us. And yeah, that's great.
Just on that, I mean, like, I was watching Steve Carell's interview, which is hilarious. Can you pinpoint who has been the best interview and who has been the worst interview?
Wow, that's a good question. Best interview. I mean, do you mean like ever in our 20 years of radio?
No, I mean like the last A-listers, because I want to get on to your best interview later on. But like you mentioned there, A-listers, you know, you've built this relationship with movie companies. Who's been the best and worst?
Well, the worst, to be honest with you, there's not that many A-listers who are bad interviews. They get the game. Like they know what they have to do. There are definitely some people who are tired and are kind of
a bit dry.
They've done a lot of these interviews today and a lot of these interviews in their life. There are a lot of movie stars who sign up to the movie junket because that's how their contract is worded and they have to do this thing and they don't want to be there. And they are professional and they smile and they answer the questions. But you can tell when someone is really not that into it and they're just literally fulfilling a brief. That's fine. We get it. Like, you know, you don't take offense to that. It's not, you know, it's nothing other than them just doing their job. So I would honestly would struggle to tell you about a bad A-lister interview because they're all really good. I think, I'll tell you what, I'll give you one story that encapsulates both. Is Daddy's Home is a movie with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. And Daddy's Home 2, we did both junkets. The first junket went so well that they gave us the second junket. And the first junket was Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg in studio. We didn't have to go to them. They came to us. It was phenomenal, right? The second junket was Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg, Mel Gibson, and John Lithgow. And not only did they come to us, but they went to a venue that we set up and brought listeners to and allowed listeners to sit in the room with the guys and have an interview. So this was incredible. But in the first interview, the two boys stayed across in the Westbury Hotel in Dublin, which is a 3-minute walk from Today FM, maybe. Mm. And we had a certain time they had to be there or whatever. So about 10 minutes before the time, the lift opened and Will Ferrell just got out of the lift at our receptionist and was like, hey, I'm here for an interview with Dermot and Dave. And they were like, oh my God, it's Will Ferrell. He's in reception. There was no one with him. There was no minder. There was no security. It was just Will Ferrell who walked over with a coffee from the Westbury and came into the building. And then just at exactly the moment that they had to be there, seven, and this is not an exaggeration, seven black SUVs pulled up outside Today FM. And Mark Wahlberg and his security team got out of the seven SUVs and they came upstairs and everybody had a job and everybody had a thing. And this woman said, I need to go into the studio with Mark Wahlberg. And again, fair play to our producer Maria. She said, no, nobody goes into the studio. It was Mark and Will and the two boys. Like, no, I have to be in the studio. She's like, well, no, you're not going in. So you can either not go in or you can not do the interview. And she went fine and stood beside the window and looked in. Now, when Mark Wahlberg got in there, he was very nice. Like, Will Ferrell is exactly like you think Will Ferrell is going to be. He's so warm. He is so friendly. He's so interested. And you also think, like, you can feign that sincerity. You know what I mean? Like, anyone could do that. Like, oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Tell me about your family and your kids and blah, 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 whatever. And the proof was in the pudding. The second time we met Will Ferrell, he again, was this Daddy's Home 2 junket where they all came and they came to this venue in Dublin City and we had a listener and whatever. So we were already doing our show on stage and Will Ferrell came in with the guys, and Mel Gibson and Mark Wahlberg and John Lithgow. They all sat down and we were talking away. And the first time we interviewed him, we had given Will Ferrell, I'm going to think now, I think it's a Wexford jersey. Anyway, it was a GAA jersey from wherever his ancestors were.
Longford.
Longford. Thank you. Thank you. So we gave him a Longford jersey. And the second time we interviewed him was, how long was it between Daddy's Home, Daddy's Home 2? I'm going to say 3 years. I don't know. Yeah. Like a long time. And Will Ferrell, we started talking about Longford. And I said, I don't know if you remember, Will. And he put up his hand and stopped me. And he unzipped his jacket and opened his jacket to reveal he was wearing the Longford jersey. So you've got to think in your head, Cian, what does it take for this guy to come home from the junkets all across the world for Daddy's Home, get a jersey, a Longford jersey, put it somewhere and write on it or tell his assistant or his wife or someone, go, the next time I go to Today FM, to Dermot and Dave in Ireland, I need to wear this jersey because the lads gave it to me and I'm going to surprise them. And then 3 years later, he comes and he takes it off and goes, wow. Here I am. Like that level of soundness, that level of genuine interest is... Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to get that. And it's not anyone's fault. It's not that you expect every A-lister to do that. But I remember Will Ferrell, when we were in between, you know, in between interviews, in songs or ad breaks, was asking us about our kids. And then when we interviewed him again, when we were in between ad break, or in between interview bits and ad breaks and songs, we'd stand up, we'd have a chat on stage or whatever. And he was like, you guys have got like 7 kids between you. Isn't that right? Like, how do you remember that stuff? Like, you know. And look, I know the rule is the more famous you get, the better you are at this stuff. Hmm. I get that. But to still see it happen in real life is actually genuinely phenomenal, you know?
Yeah, and not only did he wear it on your show, he wore it on The Late Late Show as well.
He did. Yeah, he sure did.
Because that's how I remember the Longford jersey.
There you go.
But like, you mentioned Mark Wahlberg there. Has there been any... I don't want to say... I mentioned you did the worst interview, but has there been any testing interview? You mentioned Mark Wahlberg's assistant trying to get him, but you said he was fine in the actual interview. Have you ever, mid-interview, felt, oh God, we need to work hard here?
I mean, not again, not with celebrities who tend to be, you know, they tend to be on. They tend to be kind of, I know my job here, I've got to entertain. I've got to, like, sometimes you can get a listener on the phone who can send in the world's greatest text message. And then you can get them on the phone and they just cannot.
Yeah.
They cannot replicate. They can't deliver it. They can't kind of, they can't blow you away in the way they did when they wrote it down. That's not their fault. That's not their job. They're like, they might be a farmer or a pharmacist or a butcher or whatever. Their job isn't to be an entertainer on the radio, but your text was so good. And then you get them on, you're like, oh, this is live and this is not working out the way we planned it, you know? So certainly, yeah, there've been lots of moments like that. Or there's lots of moments where, you know, you're fearful somebody might say something, the wrong thing or whatever. But again, if it's a listener, 999 times out of 1,000, they're just like us. They're just sound people having a chat. And I find it incredible that they come on the radio and talk to us without, you know, years of media training that we all have and experience, whatever. They just come on and just talk to us and have the crack. So I know what you're getting at. And look, there are interviews where people are disinterested. I mean, remember interviewing Jackass. This was one of our very, very first interviews. It was the whole cast of Jackass. And they were so hungover. We were on breakfast on 98 FM. So we were like interviewing them at like 20 past eight. They were over at 8 o'clock. And these lads probably got in at 6 o'clock. And some people are different hangover people. Like most of them were so, probably still drunk. They were giddy. They were kind of, they were leaning into the hangover, and a guy called Dave English was just hanging. He was just so hungover, and he was just like, everything we said, he was just like, oh, I just didn't want to be there. He didn't want to. And you kind of go, you might start going, oh, this is a difficult interview because he's really difficult. Like, you just kind of go, he's just so hungover. Just leave him be and ask other people questions. You know what I mean? Like, so you kind of did lots of those.
Yeah. But I do want to move on a bit, but it was just interesting to see, like, you've interviewed a very, very famous people and celebrities, and you've had heard stories of the few years about, you know, testing interviews, celebrities not wanting to be there, as you mentioned. But I do want to move on. Will I be right in saying you're about 20 years into radio this summer?
Yes. This August, in fact, will be 20 years on radio and 20 years with Dermot.
How did it all start?
In a way that no other radio show has ever started. So if you listen to this and you want to get into radio, please do not think this is how it happens, because it isn't. Dermot had a much more traditional path into radio. He wanted to work in radio. He worked for free on a local community radio station. He got a job in 98FM in the newsroom. He was a reporter, a newsreader. He did some comedy sketches and impersonations for the late night show. He moved on to doing comedy impersonations for the breakfast show. And then that breakfast show got sacked, as happens in radio. Unfortunately, ratings didn't go the way they wanted and the radio show was finished. So 98FM saw a talent in Dermot and said, this guy would be interesting to see if he could do it on his own, but he's going to need a crew around him. He's going to do a breakfast show. So let's go and put people with him. But somebody somewhere decided that instead of putting, you know, an experienced radio bunch of people together, they would find new talent. And I am forever grateful that they did that, because that's where they found me. So I had no interest in radio. I'd never been in a radio station. I had never been on radio other than trying to win tickets to something on, you know, on whatever station I was listening to at that exact moment. I like death metal, and radio stations don't tend to play that very much. So I listen to my own music all the time, not tune into radio stations. But I was a music producer and a songwriter. And when you work for yourself, as I did for 5 years, you do any kind of job that comes your way because you don't know when the next job is coming. So one of the things I did was I would record voiceover show reels for voiceover artists and comedians and actors and all that kind of stuff, because it's quite a lucrative business to get into voiceovers. You get the right campaign that goes on television. I mean, you can earn thousands of euro, and every time it comes back on television, you earn thousands of euro again. It's a great gig. So I did a voiceover demo, and I did impersonations, cartoons, cartoon voices. I speak different languages. So I put this kind of 3-minute stream of consciousness together with sound effects and music, and because that's what I did. And I got one job as a voiceover for a pizza delivery company. And the next phone call I got was from 98FM to see what I do at the breakfast show, except they didn't tell me any of those things. They didn't tell me who they were, what they were ringing about. They just said, will you meet me in town? I went in, met this woman. We had a chat, met some guys, had another chat. Then 2 days later, did some other stuff with a microphone in town. And then that was Monday, Wednesday. Then on the Friday, they brought me into a building and they put me in a room with another guy. And they literally said, you two get on. We'll be back in 20 minutes. So it was like an adult play date. And that guy was Dermot. And we've been together every single day of our lives since.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Yeah, proper crazy.
How did you first find your first live show on The Breakfast Show?
I'll be honest with you, Cian. I don't have any particular memories of the first one. And I think the reason for that is because we actually kind of eased our way in a bit. So we did a couple of shows. I think there were 4 to 6 a.m. or maybe even 3 to 5. They were like in the middle of the night. And we kind of just didn't know what we were doing, which was fine because it was our first show. And then we started on breakfast. I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I genuinely don't remember. What I do remember is our roles were reversed. So because Dermot had 2 years of radio experience and I'd never been in the station before, he was the anchor. He ran the desk. He did all of that. And I was just over on the other side of the microphone. And pretty quickly, I can't remember how quickly, maybe within a few months, we kind of realized that with my skill set coming from a studio background, that I'd be much more comfortable running the desk.
Yes.
And anchoring, and Dermot being the witty, quick-thinking comedian he is, would be much better, you know, chiming in with stuff and being funny about things. It was much more natural for him to do that. So we swapped roles and we haven't looked back since. I think that was about 6 months in.
Looking back from then to now, why did it work? Why was it so popular?
Because we genuinely get on. We genuinely have all, like literally the first day we met, we became instant best friends. It doesn't happen very often,
yeah,
but we genuinely did. And then on top of that, because we didn't have a lot of experience, we didn't have any crutches, we didn't have any expectations, we didn't have any perception of what a radio show should sound like. And at this time, this was 2002, this was a long time ago, but at that time, there were still a lot of radio personalities that were larger than life and maybe elevated above their audience. So, you know, that because radio DJs before that in the 80s and the 90s were huge, like big personalities. And, you know, they would work on radio, work on TV. They would, if they came to your town, it would be like a major thing, like that somebody from, you know, a radio station was there, whatever. They would be, whereas when we came in, there was a movement, slowly there was beginning to be a movement away from the kind of personality jock, they call it, like the jock performance, yeah, to people being more real. And we were so real because we didn't know what we were doing. So people really gravitated towards us, and very quickly. Like, I remember we started our radio show in August, and there would have been, say, there would have been the first ratings would have come out in October, say, but that would have been for half of that ratings book, we wouldn't have been on air. So it couldn't be called our first book. The second one came out in February, and we, the station's breakfast show, when they had lost their jobs, had gone from first to third, I think. And then we started in August, and by February we were number one. Wow. And that, yeah, that's quick, and that doesn't tend to happen. Huh. And so people really kind of resonated with the fact that we were just two normal lads. Neither of us sounded like a DJ. We still don't. We're the same as the people listening. That's how we view it. We're just like you. And we are. Like, we genuinely are. We're not, it's not an act. Like, yeah, we're just two lads who happened to have found our way into a studio. Like,
yeah.
And so, yeah, so then, so I think it's really kind of, people really responded to that. And I think that's why it has been so successful. And we haven't had to kind of markedly change what we do over the years, because ultimately the personality of the show is the same today as it was 20 years ago. Sure, we're better now. We're slicker. We know what we're doing. We know what works, what doesn't work. But the core personality is still the same.
But that unpredictability and that risk taken, does that lack, let's say, in today's Irish radio or even Irish media as a whole?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, like, if you listen to radio stations, no matter where you are, you'll find personalities on breakfast, on drive, across the day, in the evening times, at night, late night shows. You find lots of people who are doing things that I would view as really good content. I mean, like anything, radio becomes homogenous. Like, TV becomes homogenous. Movies become homogenous. Like, if your movie isn't about a superhero right now, it's probably not going to do as well as all of the superhero movies are going to do. So should every movie be about superheroes? No. But are 80% of the successful movies about superheroes? Yeah. So, like, you can still make a movie about something that isn't a superhero, but the chances are it won't be as successful. And I think every industry works like that. So right now, maybe what you're seeing as a lack of ambition or a lack of diversity or whatever it is really just the demand for what people want, you know, from radio has narrowed to what they're currently getting. And yes, you know, will it revolutionize? Will there be something else? Of course there will. Of course, like, that's how it got to where it is today. That's why 20 years ago, everybody was talking like this and we're on the radio and talking like that all the time. And you know, guys, like, no one talks that anymore because there's no room for that. Like, people are, they want something more real and relatable. And somebody talking like the way I'm talking to you now, which is the way I talk to everybody, is way more appealing. But I guarantee you, in 10 years, this probably won't be the way people talk on radio. I don't know what it'll be, but, you know, these things move in cycles and they change, and you have to move with them as best you can to remain relevant, or at least relevant to the audience that you're broadcasting to. So, yeah, so I think there's room for change. No doubt about it, there's room for change. But it has to be a process rather than an explosion, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Can you reflect on the last, I'd say, 20 years with yourself and Dermot? What has been the single highlight of those 20 years?
It's going to sound corny and schmaltzy, but it's him. It's us. Like, I could pick out moments. Yeah, there was, it was great fun when we went to the Euros in Poland in 2012. It was great fun when we did the broadcast from the school in Fairview in Dublin in 2008, and the kids swore on radio live during the traffic. Like, there are great moments. But if you ask me to look back and distill the last 20 years, it's literally sitting in a room with my best friend. And that is our job. Our job is to sit there, have fun, play tunes, make people happy. It's an honor. It's a genuine honor that that is how I make a living. And the fact that I can do it with somebody that I genuinely look forward to seeing every single day. Like, it's, if you think about your, even your friendships, you know, your relationships, anything that you're in, your family, you're just sometimes just sick of them. You know what I mean? Like, you're sick of your mates. You're sick of your girlfriend. You're sick of your boyfriend. You're sick of your husband, your wife. You're sick of your kids. You're sick of your parents, whatever it is. But like, obviously you love them, so it comes back around and you're fine. But like, I get in there every day. I look at them and I don't go, this bloody idiot again. Like, I genuinely go, get up in the morning and go, oh, I'm stressed about this and I have this. And then I go, yeah, but I'm just going to go into the station now with Dermot and just have to crack for like 5 hours. That's my job, is to go with my best mate and just have the crack. That's brilliant. Nice. So I think that is the thing that I will take away from 20 years, from 30 years, from 40 years, however long we're together, is the honor of being able to just hang out with him every single day, that we enjoy each other's company so much, that we have so much respect for each other. And all of the things that are important, like in a relationship, we just have it in spades. Like, it is really, really an honor.
Wow. That's amazing to hear, that like two people work together, have that amount of respect and that amount of fondness for each other.
But look at it. I mean, if you look at duos around the world, particularly in radio, they don't last. And I don't mean that. It's not anyone's fault.
No, that's true.
It's just natural human. Like, 3 years is the standard life cycle of a radio breakfast show, because you've 18 months where two people who don't really know each other get together, they get to know each other, they do really well, and then 18 months for the whole thing to fall apart. Yeah. And they might hate each other, but the show just mightn't work. Or they might hate each other, even though the show was really good, and they just go, do you know what, I can't do this anymore. And 3 years is the standard cycle. Well, we're in our seventh three-year cycle.
Defied logic.
Yeah, it literally has defied logic. And look, there are other examples. I mean, there are Australian radio duos, UK TV radio duos that are still knocking about, but it's rare. It's genuinely rare.
Absolutely. I have about 5 minutes, it's saying, left, because Zoom is playing havoc. So I'm going to have to scrap my United. It's probably good that we do scrap it, because I think it could be a few rants or something about that.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to the quick fire round.
Okay.
Who is your favourite radio host?
Dermot Whelan.
Apart from Dermot.
My favourite radio host apart from Dermot Whelan. I grew up with my dad driving into work. He used to drop me into work, and very early in the morning, Maxie would be on. And Maxie would do a show. I think it was called Rising Time, I think. Anyway, it's the early, early show on, would have been RTÉ Radio 1. Okay. And Maxie was just so calm. And she would say, and that was Clannad. And now we listen to Tchaikovsky. And I was just like, I don't like any of this, but she's brilliant.
Yeah.
So I have a really fond, fond memories of Maxie.
Okay. What is your favorite pastime?
Playing guitar. My number one favorite anything in the world is playing guitar.
What would be your second favorite?
Playing bass.
playing piano.
Looking at my guitar collection now. What else do I love? I love football. And I know you're joking with Man United, but I absolutely adore Man United. I bleed red. It's I absolutely love watching Man United. Anything to do with Man United, I'm obsessed.
Just very quick, like, what do you make of the current situation at Man United?
Very happy. Very happy. Things are turning. Yeah, right now I'm very happy. Look, you know, is it all going to change overnight? We're going to challenge for titles and win the Champions League? No. But do we have a manager now who seems to have taken stock of the situation at Man United and gone, I'm not signing this contract until X, Y, and Z changes. Because the problem isn't the players. The problem isn't the manager. The problem is the structure of the club and the way it's run. And if you look at a club that has broken David Moyes, Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho, Michael Carrick, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Ralph Rangnick, and if you go into that and go, sure, I'll go into that, well then, what's the definition of insanity? Is repeating the same thing over again and expecting a different result. So Erik ten Hag, to me, and he hasn't played a match, competitive match yet, and I could be totally wrong, but it looked to me like he took his time to sign that contract because he said to them, I'm not walking in there. I can go anywhere. I can stay Ajax or I can go somewhere else where the structure is better. Improve the structure and the way things are run. And look, other things have to happen, but Woodward is gone. Richard Arnold is running it in a very different way. John Murtaugh is the director of football or whatever his title is. Darren Fletcher's in there. And I can tell by the way things are being handled that it's different. Is it the right thing? Is it going to make everything perfect? I've no idea because I can't predict the future. But I'm very hopeful now that the structures at the club are better than they were. I don't think they're going to be as good as, you know, Chigiristan at Man City or, you know, FSG at Liverpool, you know, because they've been doing that way for years. And Cheeky and the lads know exactly what they're doing. But do I think it's better than it was? Yes. Do I think they're trying to solve the problems that actually make a difference? Yes. And is the full answer to get rid of the Glazers? Of course it is. But that's also not going to happen, at least not without a fight, at least not without someone coming in that has as questionable an ownership as the Glazers do. So given the situation we find ourselves in, I am currently very happy and very hopeful.
Very good. What is your biggest advice to young people looking to get into radio?
Do a podcast. You're doing it, Keane. This is the number one advice I give to anybody. Do a podcast. And here's the thing. It doesn't matter what the podcast is about. I don't care if your podcast is about fly fishing or sap inside of a tree. If you do a podcast for 1 year, and do it once a week, 1 year, you have 52 episodes to make a demo out of and to learn from. And I guarantee you, your podcast number one versus podcast 52 will be chalk and cheese. You'll be so good at podcast 52 versus how bad you were at podcast number one. But if you don't do that, if you're trying to get into radio or you're trying to get into, you know, broadcasting in general, and you don't do a podcast and do it consistently and do it week after week after week, when you're tired, when you're supposed to be on holidays, when you've got to work and you've got to study and you've got to do whatever, you've just got to commit that every Wednesday night I'm going to upload that episode, or every Tuesday morning, or whatever it is, and no excuses. Do your podcast. 52 episodes later, you'll be so much better at whatever it is you want to do. And as I said, it doesn't matter what it's about. When you're sending that demo into a station manager, program director, whatever it is, they don't care if you're passionate about collecting buttons off cardigans, as long as you demonstrate to them that you're passionate and that, you know, because I mean, ultimately, what are they going to judge it on? Everyone's going to send the demo. It's the same thing. It's somebody talking into a microphone. You might as well talk about something you actually care about. Yeah. So that's my advice. Do a podcast, do it all the time, do it for a year, and then make a demo.
Absolutely. We have 30 seconds left. Last question. Describe yourself in 3 words.
Guitar playing, that's a hyphen, guitar playing United fan.